From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there are now 35 days until the inauguration of Donald Trump. This week, President-elect Trump filled out his cabinet, naming people such as ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State and former Texas Governor Rick Perry as Energy Department head. He also canceled a press conference aimed at clearing up conflict of interest issues involving his business empire. So let's get to our weekly roundtable.
Greg Moore is here. He's former editor of the Denver Post and visiting journalism professor at the University of Colorado. Hi, Greg.
Hey, how are you? Good to be here.
Good to have you. And so is Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Rick, hi to you.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so biggest story of the week, clearly Trump continues to resist the CIA's conclusion that the Russian government interfered in the election. Yesterday, Trump tweeted that if Russia or some other entity was hacking, why did the White House wait so long to act? Why did they only complain after Hillary Clinton lost? Now, we know, Rick, that that statement is not true. The administration warned about this in October. Why won't Donald Trump let this go?
This is the biggest question in Washington right now. Not just why doesn't he let it go, but also why doesn't he accept what the intelligence community has said with consensus, that there was an attempt by the Russians to infiltrate the election. He is chalking it all up to politics, and seems that his initial response is, if you say anything about Russian hacking, you're questioning the legitimacy of his election. I think they are different issues, and they are important issues, and I think it's now going to be put back on the Obama administration, as you point out, 35 more days as president, to produce evidence, perhaps, to push forward investigation, to say publicly what his concerns may or may not be have been before the election, and to push this ahead, because clearly the incoming Trump administration wants it to go away.
Well, and let's listen to what the White House had to say about this. This is White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest at a White House press conference.
Mr. Trump obviously knew that Russia was engaged in malicious cyber activity that was helping him and hurting Secretary Clinton's campaign.
And then Trump responded by attacking Earnest at a rally last night in Hershey, Pennsylvania.
Although this foolish guy, Josh Earnest, I don't know if he's talking to President Obama. You know, having the right press secretary is so important because he is so bad the way he delivers a message. He can deliver a positive message and it sounds bad.
Greg, we heard early on in the transition President Obama and President-elect Trump talking in very nice ways about one another. Is that breaking down because of this?
Oh, definitely. I think that marks the end of the nicey-nicey, you know, Donald Trump. I really like him a lot. I think the gloves are coming off. I think Obama's had a look at how the Trump administration is being put together. It's an all-out assault on his legacy, and I think he's going to take the gloves off, and I think you're going to see a lot of back and forth, more than what we're accustomed to with a former president. Once Obama leaves the White House, I think he's going to be taking on Trump and his policies in a full-throated way. Mm.
Rick, we may get a clue to this in just a couple of hours because President Obama has a press conference today. How do you expect him to thread that needle?
I think this is actually a defining moment, not just in this period of the lame duck period, but potentially for his entire legacy. How this transition happens, what kind of cloud and suspicions and handoff we're talking about, so critical here. President Obama, whatever you say about him, has clearly done his best to try to make this an orderly and peaceful transition with as many good feelings as possible. He and Donald Trump, we're told, have spoken multiple times directly. But there is a snag, and there is significant concern between the teams. There's mistrust among the teams. And right now, the very real issue, a national security issue that's being raised by his team and his intelligence agencies, how he responds to that, how does he respond to the calls for even intelligence briefings for members of the Electoral College? Does he believe that the election was actually influenced by the Russians? Those are key questions for him to answer that I think have long-term implications.
Let's talk about the Trump cabinet that is shaping up. And after that long dance with Mitt Romney, we finally found out that the pick for Secretary of State is Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil. And he's already getting some criticism or maybe a roadblock from some Republican senators, including Lindsey Graham, who had this to say on Fox News.
My question, Mr. Tillerson, do you realize what Russia's up to here and all over the world, and are you willing to do something about it? Do you support new sanctions? And if he doesn't, I'd be very hard for me to vote for him because you're giving a green light to this behavior.
Now, we've talked on this show this week about the fact that filibusters aren't going to work for these because the Democrats changed the rules, so they only need a majority in the Senate to get these nominees through. But Greg, do you see Tillerson and maybe others facing some trouble getting confirmed?
I think there are going to be some tough questioning. It's an important opportunity for the Democrats to flex their muscle and really show that they can be an effective opposition to a Trump administration. But I think these nominees are going to be confirmed. I also think it's important to understand that Tillerson and some of these other business people, it's totally different when you're running a business and you're dealing with heads of state and that kind of thing. I think Tillerson will be able to sort of respond to Graham's questions in a way that will not lead to the blocking of his nomination. It's totally different being a diplomat than being a businessman.
Rick, what do you think about that? Because I know you spoke with West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who is a Democrat, and he told you that he might actually vote for Tillerson's confirmation. At least he's open to doing so. That would make the road a lot smoother.
Oh, he sounds like a yes vote, and I think there are a couple of Democrats, and Manchin most prominent among them, that are actually going to work pretty well with this Trump White House. Manchin also saying that he's already talked more with President-elect Trump than he ever talked over 8 years with President Obama, despite the fact that they're from opposite parties.
That's fascinating. What does that say to you about Donald Trump?
Well, it says that Trump has been given some good briefing notes on who to potentially talk to. There are people like Joe Manchin that functionally are more Republican than Democrat, and you can pick them off on some things. And he's not going to be known and never is going to be known as a post-partisan figure, a bipartisan figure. But there will be Democrats that he will intrigue with some of his outreach. And I think whether it's cabinet appointments or some of his early pushes around legislation, look at the infrastructure package that they seem to be putting together, they're going to find some ways to work with Democrats. That's one of the ways that he is already changed Washington, is that there's opportunities for bipartisanship that just weren't there and wouldn't have been there, frankly, if Hillary Clinton had won in all likelihood.
Donald Trump can't. You know, go ahead, Greg. Yeah.
One of the things I'm really anxious to see is, you know, there's been a clamoring in this country probably since the time of Perot to see what it would be like if you had businessmen running the government and if government was run like a business. And I think that's one of the things we're going to find out in these first couple of years of the Trump administration. It's going to be interesting to see.
Donald Trump canceled this planned press conference this week to talk about his conflicts of interest, and we're hearing more about his son's activity in the transition. And now that Ivanka Trump may be in the First Lady's office in the White House, or what's traditionally been the First Lady's office in the White House, that's Donald Trump's daughter. Rick, is he going to separate himself from his business? Is his family going to be running the business and working in the White House, or how might this play out?
By all accounts, he is not going to separate himself with anywhere near the bright lines that ethics experts inside and outside the government say are necessary. And there's very little that can be done about it other than asking questions of congressional oversight and scrutiny. Of course, he promised a press conference to talk about these things. He canceled it. He said that these are actually very easy things to figure out. They're the opposite of that. And to me, the big looming building just half a mile from the White House, that the Trump International Hotel, where already people are renting out space for holiday parties, and it's going to be a destination with literally his name on it.
Is he going to be able to keep that? Because isn't there something written that says you can't be a part of the federal government and part of this contract?
Technically, he'll be in violation of the contract the moment he takes the oath of office. The question is what's done about it, and how do you actually spin that off if the kids are in charge and you know the kids are part of the transition team and one of the kids is part of the White House and the West Wing and a son-in-law is there? It's all so interconnected. This is utterly uncharted territory, and to have a national, international brand, all the foreign entanglements, the financial interests, and Donald Trump hasn't really said anything about how he's going to sort it out.
And here's another example. This week, Trump's children were there when he held a summit with tech CEOs earlier this week. They were at the table sitting down with people like Tim Cook of Apple, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Elon Musk of Tesla. Greg, what are your thoughts on these conflicts of interest potentials for them?
I think running our government is not a family business. I agree completely with Rick that the separation of his personal interest from his role as the leader of our government is nowhere near where it needs to be. And I think journalism and journalists are going to have a field day. The leaks that are going to be coming out of the federal government about what Trump has done or how policy has influenced his business and things like that, there's no way that Trump, as president, can plug all of those potential leaks. And people inside his own government are going to be reporting on the conflicts and the things that are not happening the way they should be. So I think that, you know, he's going to get off to a very rocky start from day one because of, you know, his involvement of his families and his refusal to disentangle himself from his business interest.
Rick, just a few seconds here, but just on the Democratic side, we know that Labor Secretary Tom Perez is getting into the race to run the DNC against Keith Ellison of Minnesota. And what do you think will happen there?
There may be other candidates as well. There's a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party because they're trying to figure out, do you go more in the liberal direction, do you more conservative direction, more of a rural direction?
Right.
They are in tatters as a party right now, and they're just beginning that rebuilding process. And I think this fight, as it plays out with the establishment against more of the liberal ring in Ellison, will be a critical one.
That's Rick Klein of ABC News and Greg Moore at the University of Colorado. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Happy holidays.
You too. It's Here and Now. A federal judge has temporarily stopped a rule that was supposed to go into effect Monday in Texas. It would require health care facilities to cremate or bury remains of any miscarriages or abortions, regardless of how far along the pregnancy was or the woman's wishes. Supporters say fetal remains should not be treated like medical waste, but health care providers and funeral homes are worried. They say the implications of the rule are unclear and possibly costly. Ashley Lopez from Here and Now contributor KUT reports.
Daryl Thompson runs the Weed Corley Fish Funeral Home in Austin.
As we continue our general visitation area, a very common area where families gather for visitations.
Thompson says for years he's worked with a local Catholic hospital as part of a community service. Sometimes he's asked to deal with the fetal remains of a miscarriage. Usually, he says, the hospital chaplain arranges a funeral at a local cemetery. Other times, he's asked to step in.
Families are certainly given the opportunity to make disposition of their family members, and if they elect not to, then the hospital will call us, and we will take care of that process. Now, this is one specific group.
Catholic hospitals handle fetal remains through burials or cremations because they believe life begins at conception. But not all healthcare providers are Catholic or even religious. But Texas leaders want to require that all healthcare providers deal with fetal remains that way. And that includes remains from abortions as well as miscarriages. This means Thompson can go from disposing of fetal remains once every 3 months, like he does now, to doing it way more often. How often?
Well, I don't know that I really have a solid answer for you with that. We haven't been provided with any information other than this rule will take effect.
All that bothers Thompson. He says he doesn't have an opinion on the new rule, but he doesn't like that there's so much uncertainty about how to comply with it. It was a state agency rule, not a law passed by the legislature, so stakeholders like Thompson didn't have as much input. There was a public comment period and some hearings, but the rule essentially didn't change. That's even though the Texas Medical Association and the Texas Hospital Association had significant issues with it. For example, they say forcing a woman who suffered a miscarriage to bury the fetus would make a difficult situation even more difficult.
I really feel this was a very rapid, quick decision. I don't think that all the implications were considered.
But not everyone thinks the creation of this new rule on the treatment of fetal remains was haphazard. Amy Hagstrom Miller is the CEO of a chain of Texas abortion providers called Whole Women's Health. She says state leaders introduced this rule after her group won a court battle with the state over a set of regulations that restricted access to abortion.
Texas put forward these proposed rules just 4 days after our June victory in the Supreme Court, and I think there's a direct connection. And I think this time, once again, Texas has really gone too far.
This week, Whole Women's Health and others filed another lawsuit against the state of Texas. Part of what they're arguing is that the fetal remains rule is too vague. And then Miller says there are costs. Funerals are thousands of dollars, which could make them too expensive for many women. And cremation, she says, is just another hurdle.
To date, we've only found one crematorium in the entire state of Texas that is willing to work with the abortion care providers. And that's not a path to compliance. That is, a very obvious bottleneck that's going to put services at risk throughout the state for the women who need us.
The Department of State Health Services declined to do an interview about their new rule, but officials say it does not unduly burden individuals seeking abortions. David Brown with the Center for Reproductive Rights disagrees.
what an undue burden means, in the words of the Supreme Court, is a law that imposes pointless burdens without any benefit at all.
The state also says healthcare facilities should be able to absorb the cost of the new rule. But some providers say that's not true. And funeral home director Daryl Thompson says no one really knows what this will cost everyone, including him.
Hopefully it will not impact families financially, and I could perhaps see that that could happen. So I guess as the adage goes, we will see.
U.S. District Court Judge Sam Sparks halted the law until he gets a chance to rule on it. Hearings are set for January 3rd. Sparks is likely to have a ruling by January 6th. Indiana Governor and Vice President-elect Mike Pence signed a similar measure, but it was struck down by a federal court. And a Field Remains disposal law is on hold in Louisiana, pending legal challenges. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Lopez.
Well, Google released its list of the year's most popular searches this week, and at the top of the list, Pokemon Go. Susan Kadrecha is one of Google's search trends experts. She joins us from Mountain View, California, by Google Hangouts, of course. Susan, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
And Pokemon Go, I have to say I was a little surprised to see that, given all the other things that happened this year between the U.S. election and Brexit and everything else. But how many searches did it actually get?
So, you know, it's really interesting to see this. This is an annual thing that we do every year to kind of measure what was hot in the year past. And what we're looking at is actually not quantity of searches, but it's actually the highest spike of search interest over a sustained period of time as compared to 2015. So it really is those huge spikes. So like you said, something like Pokemon Go may seem very surprising. I'll admit that I was a little surprised myself, but there was such an insane interest for this game that people, of course, were playing on their phones trying to catch Pokemon. It kind of just took over this summer, and that high spike has brought it to the number one spot.
Well, and in the U.S., the number one spot went to Powerball, right?
Yes, yes, correct. Here in the U.S., Powerball was the top spot. And like you said, it's that incredibly high spike that we saw last January, where we had that unprecedented Powerball jackpot, which rose to more than $1.6 billion. And it's really interesting to see. I'm not sure if people out there were more interested in trying their luck at the lottery, but it was definitely the year for Powerball here in the U.S.
And in Australia, and this might be a little embarrassing to some people in the United States, the top search was U.S. elections. So they're searching for the elections. We're searching for the Powerball numbers. What else was big? What stood out to you on the lists?
So interestingly, I mean, I was surprised here in the U.S. You can see that actually the 8th, 9th, and 10th search queries were actually Trump, election, and Hillary Clinton across the board here in the U.S. And I was surprised to see that those, you know, not that they were on the list, but they were closer to the bottom. And I think what was interesting for the election, particularly, we saw a huge spike in interest for how to register to vote. A lot of questions around trying to understand the distinction between the Electoral College and the popular vote. We got a ton of queries around that. So not necessarily the content, but the questions I thought were really interesting and insightful. People trying to understand the political process.
Something else on the list, and this happens every year. There are these things on the list that I have never even heard of before, but one of them this year was Slither.io or Slither.io. What is that?
Yes. So Slither.io, it's actually a search URL for a game where a sort of a snake-like creature competes for food. So this may, you may remember that game actually on a much older version of a phone that you just play called Snake, but it's a really interesting story to see, you know, how much an app can just explode overnight and then even land in the middle of the top U.S. list.
And when you look at other things related to technology, obviously we mentioned Pokemon Go, but what else was up there? I know the iPhone 7 was number two searched for thing on the global list.
Yes. I mean, so technology, you know, especially consumer technology is always going to be an interesting list for us. And I think, you know, we were happy to see that people were searching for the Pixel as well, which came in at number five. But yes, I mean, iPhone is always going to be something that people are looking for. There's always such a demand for it. People want to know the latest and greatest consumer technology, especially more than anything, their phones.
What about other news events beside the election? What else came up?
So globally, we saw that number one is, of course, the U.S. election, which I was very interested to see. It's always interesting to see that globally, you know, here in the U.S., that this really does radiate interest in other countries as well. Number two, I don't think this will come as a surprise, is actually the Olympics. You know, of course, that global news moment, you know, all eyes were on Rio this summer. And we saw that sort of filter and pop into other categories as well. Number three was actually Brexit. And I think that, you know, that actually appeared on the U.S. list as well. People were asking, what is Brexit? Number four, actually, was the Orlando shooting globally, which I think is really telling that these, you know, these horrible incidents that happen, you know, that they pick up a lot of news and a lot of interest in other places as well. And then number five, rounding out that list for global news, is actually the Zika virus.
Well, one more thing I want to ask you about, and you guys look at all kinds of different categories of searches and break them down, and we'll link people to that at hereandnow.org. But drinks is up there, and the different cocktails that people are searching for. I guess sangria in the U.S. is what people are looking at.
You know, it's always fun to see the top search drinks because it sort of like gives you a sense of what people are interested in consuming. I think food is always going to be a cool one. And actually, speaking of that, there's a really cool list that I wanted to quickly cover, is actually the calorie searches. This is something that we look at particularly here in the U.S. That number one is actually people were searching for Big Mac. I feel like whether you're at a restaurant or the grocery store, you have the ability to know exactly what you're consuming and if that's a good choice.
Usually deciding that it's not a good choice after looking up the calories.
Right. I feel like if you're looking up the calorie, you may be concerned about it, in which case it may not be the good decision. But for those of you out there here in the U.S., there are 563 calories in a Big Mac. And that was the number one calorie search this year.
That's Susan Kadrecha with Google Search Trends. And again, we'll link you at hereandnow.org. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The United Nations top health official in Syria says negotiations are underway to resume the evacuation of eastern Aleppo. The humanitarian effort was halted this morning. The government and the rebels are blaming each other. NPR's Allison Muse joins us now from Beirut. And Allison, this ceasefire has been on again, off again several times now in the past several days. What's the latest you're hearing about why the evacuation stopped this time?
That's correct. It's been a tense couple days after a failed attempt. Then finally, yesterday, we saw the promised evacuation begin. And the Red Cross and its partner, the Syrian Red Crescent, started bringing convoys out. And thousands of people have been evacuated, including hundreds of children, the most critically wounded people. But things stalled today, as you've heard.
And what's the reason for that?
The reason for that, we're hearing some different things. The Syrian government says that the rebels had tried to take hostages with them on the buses, and that they'd also tried to take heavier weapons. They're only entitled to take their sidearms with them. That's what they say. The rebels deny all that, and they accuse the regime forces of taking hostages among the people that were on the convoy. So it's a bit contradictory. But then you also have Hezbollah, which is the Lebanese militia that fights alongside Assad's forces, saying that actually there was also a protest against those last buses leaving because there are two small villages in the north of Syria besieged by the rebels, and they want a similar deal for those people.
About 9,000 people have been evacuated from eastern Aleppo since Thursday. Who is left in that part of the city at this point?
We've heard mixed figures on how many people have actually gotten out, but what humanitarians tell us is that thousands remain inside. This is not done. Many people still want to leave. They fear staying after the government takes over. As to what the situation is now, the humanitarians are focused on evacuating these remaining people and also caring for tens of thousands of people who have fled to the government side in the past couple weeks and who are living in substandard shelters and have nothing.
If the Syrian government has taken now full control of Aleppo, or at least is getting closer to doing that, what does it mean for the future of this 6-year civil war, Allison?
Well, it means that the government is in a much stronger position, in that the rebels do not have a foothold in a major city anymore. You know, Aleppo was a big, big chip for them. It was something they could negotiate over. It gave them some legitimacy. Now they're kind of reduced to the countryside in different non-connected areas. North of Aleppo, Turkey is backing the rebels not to overthrow Assad, but to make sure that ISIS gets pushed back and that it's not the Kurds that are the ones doing that and creating a state on their border. You know, that's a very different goal than these activists who opposed the regime went out on the streets for. It looks like the Syrian president is here to stay, even if the country remains very divided, and even if still you have the Islamic State and Kurdish-led forces and rebels controlling vast swaths of the country.
NPR's Allison Muse in Beirut. Allison, thank you.
Thank you.
Golden Globe nominations were announced this week, and new shows got a lot of love. Of the seven shows that got the most nominations, only one, ABC's Black-ish, has been on for more than one season. Netflix's The Crown got three nominations for its first season. Claire Foy was nominated as Best Actress in a Drama Series. Here she is as Queen Elizabeth.
I am aware that I'm surrounded by people who feel that they could do the job better. Strong people with powerful characters. More natural leaders, perhaps better suited to leading from the front, making a mark. But for better or worse, the crown has landed on my head.
Well, joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
And let's start with the drama category. We've talked about a lot of these shows on air. Game of Thrones nominated once again. And just because we have an opportunity to do so for the people who have seen it or haven't seen it, let's listen here to a clip of Melisandre talking to Jon Snow, in the season 6 finale.
You've seen the Night King, Jon Snow. You know the Great War is still to come. You know the Army of the Dead will be upon us soon. And you know I can help you win that war.
Oh, when is that coming back? Okay. And then we also have in that category, Eric, Stranger Things, NBC's This Is Us, HBO's Westworld, which, as you know, I have not quite finished yet, but I'm almost there. And then The Crown, which reportedly cost more than $100 million to make. A lot in this category.
Yeah, it's sort of a reflection of the embarrassment of riches we have in TV drama these days. It's worth noting that the Golden Globes are nominated and awarded by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. So TV shows that have some sort of connection to non-American stories and actors, I think, always have a little bit of a leg up. So I'm really looking at The Crown for its focus on the British royalty. You know, we've got Westworld there, too. HBO spent a whole lot of money on this series, so there's a sense that maybe spending that money gets you, you know, closer to the winner's circle in some of these contests. And then we also have some of the most buzzed about new series in This Is Us and Stranger Things.
Yeah.
This Is Us, most buzzed about in the fall. Stranger Things, most buzzed about over the summer. So it makes a lot of sense, this category. It really does.
So who has the edge? The Crown, you're saying?
The Crown, for me, just because, like I said, it's the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. But I would say, when it comes to their winners, sometimes their winners make no sense to me. I think their nominations are a lot more savvy sometimes than the winners that they pick.
And of the three shows that I've seen there, all of them fantastic. So I guess everybody's a winner, at least as far as that goes. But let's talk about comedy. The comedy category, also a lot of big buzzed about shows. We have Amazon's Mozart in the Jungle and Transparent, HBO's Veep, Netflix's Atlanta, which we talked about a few weeks ago, and Black-ish.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting to me about this category is there's two shows in here that have won before, you know, Amazon's Transparent and Amazon's Mozart in the Jungle. And, you know, HBO's Veep is a perennial favorite. It's won many Emmy Awards. And, you know, they're all great shows. But there's been this explosion of comedy on television that's been very high quality. And, you know, shows like Insecure on HBO, and Better Things on FX, and Search Party on TBS. And, I mean, you know, there's so much great sort of individual, well-acted, well-written comedy that I'm kind of surprised that the Golden Globes didn't reach out to some of those shows and reflect them in their nominations rather than nominate two shows that have already won Best Comedy and bring several shows that are, you know, past their first season.
We have to talk about one more show here, and it's from the miniseries category. And there were two shows in that category that kind of led the way on nominations. One was The Night Manager, which got 4, and the other was one that you and I both loved, The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. And here's a clip of John Travolta as Robert Shapiro talking with Courtney B. Vance as Johnny Cochran.
I stand before you right now and say race has never and will never be an issue in this case.
Bob, this is the United States of America, and we are defending a black man who is fighting to prove his innocence. But we would not be doing our job if we did not at least talk about how race plays a part in this trial. Now, if that is playing the race card, so be it.
Is this a runaway, Eric?
So be it. So what's interesting about these two things, Courtney B. Vance's Johnny Cochran to me is like one of the towering performances in television this year. He absolutely nailed the spirit of the guy and brought new energy to a story that we thought we already knew. John Travolta's performance is like one of the weirdest performances on television in 2016. I always feel like Travolta gets these nominations because they want a star of his caliber, like in the audience for the television show. But you know, in terms of his actual performance, I think it's one. This is an amazing miniseries, and if there's been any criticism of it, it's been his performance because it's so sort of odd. But be that as it may, these are both The Night Manager and American Crime Story. They're both really great miniseries. The Night Manager, again, features some very high-profile British actors, particularly Tom Hiddleston, in a role that has left people convinced that he could be the next James Bond. So even though People v. O.J. Simpson, I think, is the superior miniseries and will be on everybody's top 10 list where The Night Manager won't be, I think The Night Manager, at least in the acting categories, may have a strong showing because, again, you know, this award is chosen by critics who are from the foreign press, and they may put a little more value on the project and its roots in international television.
Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. Eric, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
Well, running 26.2 miles in 2 hours or less has been described as the moonshot marathon, but that's precisely what a team of three men is now training to do. They'll take their shot in a specially set up race sometime next year. Here and now's Alex Ashlock reports.
Oxford, running through 3A's against the university, Roger Bannister limbers up for a planned attack on that four-minute mile never before achieved by man.
In 1954, Roger Bannister of Great Britain did something no one thought was possible.
Up to the finishing line, time 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds, shattering the four-minute mile, the Everest of athletic achievement.
The new Everest is running a longer race, a much longer race, the marathon. In 2 hours or less.
3 minutes. This is absolutely astonishing. Legendary running from Dennis Kimetto as the line approaches. Watch the clock now.
Kenya's Dennis Kimetto is the current world record holder in the marathon. 2 years ago in Berlin, he finished the 26.2-mile race in just 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds. Pretty impressive. But here's some perspective on how much faster Kimetto would have had to run per mile to hit the two-hour mark.
7 seconds a mile.
That's Ed Caesar on Skype. He's the author of 2 Hours, The Quest to Run the Impossible Marathon.
So Kimetto ran 441 miles, and these guys are going to have to run 434s. I mean, the difference between that, as anyone who's ever run in any serious way will know, is massive. It's such an audacious goal.
The three men selected by Nike to chase that audacious goal are Eliud Kipchoge of Kenya, Lalisa Desisa of Ethiopia, and Zerzene Tedese of Eritrea. Kipchoge is considered the world's best marathon runner right now. He won the Olympic marathon in Rio this past summer. Desisa is a 2-time Boston Marathon winner. And Tedese is the world half marathon champion. But Caesar says he seems to be the odd man out in this group.
Because he's run 58:23 for the half marathon, the fastest time ever. But he's never really done anything at the full marathon distance. He doesn't seem to have fulfilled his potential.
The Nike team that will try to help him fulfill his potential includes coaches, nutritionists, and psychologists. So far, they haven't released any details about the special race they'll set up next spring. But Caesar says he would stage it on a flat course, with the runners completing the same circuit several times. and other runners would help these three keep up the necessary pace.
I'd use the looped course because I'd want pacemakers to come in and out so that you could maintain this really high pace all the way through the race.
But can they do it? Can they shave nearly 3 minutes off the current world record in the marathon?
I think it's a long shot. I don't think it's impossible. If they get everything right around the race and set it up right, they could do it, but it's a huge, huge task.
And if it happens, if someone is able to run a marathon in 2 hours or less, it would be an achievement similar to Roger Bannister cracking the four-minute mile.
At one level, it means nothing, but at another level, it means everything. It's the summiting of a vast mountain that was previously unclimbable.
Bannister climbed that mountain in 1954. We'll see if someone else can do it in 2017. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
The power struggle in North Carolina continues.
You are causing a disruption to the North Carolina General Assembly. The House is in session. I have asked you to lower your voices. If you do not, I'm going to place you under arrest.
That is a police officer today in Raleigh trying to control a crowd of protesters who stormed the state capitol. 16 have been arrested today, 17 arrested yesterday. They're angry over legislation drawn up and passed by Republican lawmakers that places checks on the power of the incoming governor, who is a Democrat. Roy Cooper won November's election by little more than 10,000 votes. He said yesterday these laws are unconstitutional.
The Republican leadership and the General Assembly has put forth a number of proposed pieces of legislation over the last 12 to 24 hours. Most people might think that this is a partisan power grab, but it is really more ominous.
Jeff Tiberi is a political reporter for WUNC. Jeff, you are at the Capitol right now. What's going on?
Well, those chants that you heard just a moment ago, those are continuing to echo from the rotunda through various parts of the building. I'm in kind of the bowels of the building, and I just ducked my head out a moment ago from our studio and could still hear chanting and cheering. Kind of the repetitive nature of this is that there are various chants, call and response chants that happen, and then the zip ties come out. Protesters one by one are being arrested, and generally cheers go up for these folks as they are led away by the police departments.
Jeff, what are these laws that they're so angry about?
Well, there are really two that have advanced and that are of the utmost concern to critics. They're going to strip the governor of power. The incoming governor is a Democrat, as you mentioned. There are Republican supermajorities in both chambers of this General Assembly. Specifically, one of the bills, among the provisions, they will remove control from the governor over the state board of election. They'll remove some of his appointments to the state university system, and they'll reduce the number of political hires that he gets to make. Now, under the current Republican governor, there are about 1,500 staff positions that he can choose or hire, and this would reduce that to 300. And one other thing of note is that cabinet secretaries, whether we're talking about the environment or health and human services, someone that was going to serve under the governor previously, who the governor he or she could just appoint, would now need Senate confirmation. And what that does with this Republican supermajority is it gives them control over who serves there, obviously. But if somebody's too liberal or if somebody has an agenda that is not in line with their ideologies, they can reject that person.
Now, the context here is that this was a very close election. It dragged on for a while. You spoke with Republican Representative Jeff Collins of Nash County, which is in the northeastern part of the state. And here's what he told you.
I think anything we can do to restore a little bit of the authority to the legislature that they gave up largely in the 1980s is making a corrective action to partially rebalance what I think is a state government that's been way out of kilter. I think our framers had it right.
What are Republicans saying here about why they did this? Because their critics would argue that the legislature never would have done this if Pat McCrory, the Republican governor, had won the election.
Right. And to that question, I did ask one of the more powerful members of the House if indeed this had been talked about or, you know, if the timing of this would have been the same were Pat McCrory to have won a second term. And he kind of coyly said, well, I don't know about the time. I'm not sure if we would have taken these up at the same time. Mm-hmm. And of course they wouldn't. Right. Of course they would not have done that. They've had a Republican governor for 4 years and they've also had these supermajorities. So they could have taken back some of these powers in recent years, but they haven't done so. We should note that the North Carolina governor is not one of the more powerful ones in in the country. Huh. He or she does not have line item veto. They do have veto power. But relatively speaking, one analysis had the governor here ranked as 41st out of 50. So this removes some powers that were constitutionally under the legislature decades ago and brings them back. But certainly the timing of this, just what is it, 15 days before the Democrat moves into the executive mansion, is certainly of a real critique.
Right. Pat McCrory, of course, the lame duck, just a few more days in office, as you point out. Has he said at all whether he plans to sign these laws?
He is not, and I've reached out to his office. One staff member here at the legislature, I asked him last night, I said, how are the conversations going with the governor about these bills? And I was told some of them are going really well and some of them are going terribly. So it's early, it's fluid, it's politics, that could change. But there is an irony here, right, in that you're sending a bill that you know, adjusts government powers pretty significantly to a governor on his way out. Is he a Republican first or a governor first? And, of course, how does this impact his legacy, as many political leaders care about?
And, Jeff, really quickly, we just have a few seconds left. Do Republicans risk backlash for this in the way that Governor McCrory paid a price politically for signing House Bill 2, the bathroom bill, earlier this year?
I would answer that by noting that we will likely have special legislative elections in 2017 due to racially gerrymandered districts here. So we could know as soon as November if the voters have a short or a long-term memory and if any of those supermajorities are at risk.
Jeff Tiberi with WUNC at the State House in Raleigh. Jeff, thank you.
My pleasure.
And before we go, we'd like to thank two people. Our thanks to our intern in Washington, D.C., Trudy Joseph. Today is her last day with us. She'll be graduating from the University of Massachusetts Amherst in May. And thanks to our web intern, Munshi Sun. She's eyeing a graduate degree in journalism. We wish them both the best. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.